Hi, I'm Michael Hawk, and welcome to Nature's Archive Podcast, where I interview some of the most interesting and creative people on the forefront of conservation, ecology, birding, and environmental education. If you have a fascination with the natural world, this podcast is for you. My promise to you is that you'll not only learn what my guests have accomplished, but also how and why. And I also promise that you'll learn plenty of fascinating things about the nature that surrounds us. So give it a listen, and if you truly care about the environment and enjoyed what you heard, please take a moment to subscribe, leave feedback on Apple Podcasts or your favorite service, and share this episode with a friend. Thank you. My guest today is Ashley Ahern. Ashley is an award-winning public radio and podcast journalist. She recently created and published the critically acclaimed podcast series called Grouse. Grouse explores life in rural America through the lens of the controversial greater sage grouse. The series also delves into Ashley's own unique journey to sagebrush country and tackles many of the competing interests that threaten the grouse. You may also know Ashley from her work on the podcast Terrestrial, a show that explored personal choices in the face of climate change, and also her many varied works for PRI and NPR. She currently runs Ahern Productions, where she freelances for NPR and other clients, creates original shows such as Grouse, and helps others create quality podcasts. In this episode, we speak extensively about grouse and the art of developing and telling nuanced stories. We get into the weeds of the production process, including how to gain the trust of people who may be skeptical and initially unwilling to share their stories. We also discuss how to tell a story that stays true to multiple perspectives and how to engage and connect people using audio as a format. We also talk about Ashley's journey from NPR to freelance productions and consultations. We have a great discussion about loaded terms such as environmentalist and what fairness and bias means in the world of journalism. Ashley also gives us a sneak peek into her next podcast series, which is sure to be great. I thoroughly enjoyed this discussion and learned a lot of useful nuggets to improve my ability to engage and communicate environmental stories, and I hope that you enjoy this discussion as much as I did. So without further delay, Ashley Ahern. Ashley, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure.
So you have quite the resume in journalism and science communication, and there are a lot of places I could have chose to start this conversation. Hopefully we can hit at least a few of them today. But really the thing that triggered me to reach out to you was your recent acclaimed podcast series called Grouse. So for those that haven't heard this show, which first of all, I highly recommend they go and listen to, if not right now, right after listening to this show, can you tell me about what it is, you know, what's the subject? What was the goal of that show?
Sure. So Grouse is an 8-part podcast series I produced in 2020 that looks at the greater sage grouse and why it is considered one of the most, if not the most, controversial birds in the West, and all the different stakeholders that are fighting over what to do about the fact that its numbers continue to decline across its range. So that's the top headline of what the podcast is. But what it really is about is the urban-rural divisions in this country. And I kind of wove together my journey as a newcomer to very red conservative sagebrush country as somebody who'd lived in cities for a long time and covered the environment for more than a decade for NPR and member stations, and sort of trying to get at the crux of why we have these divisions in this country right now and why conservation issues like climate change, like sage-grouse, endangered species, spotted owl, end up oftentimes as these lightning rods or symbols of these divisions. So I kind of used the sage grouse as a way to explore both my personal journey in sagebrush country, but also the greater divides in our country between urban and rural right now.
It definitely hits close to home, given current events. And I have to say the storytelling is just wonderful, the way you were able to intertwine all those different elements. As a result, people of all walks of life can identify with the story. And that leads me to a question of, did you first have the idea to use the greater sage grouse as this element, or did you have the broader idea of trying to find a story element that would, you know, help you bring together these different elements? If you could walk me through the genesis story, so to speak, of this series.
Sure. It's funny because, you know, sage grouse have been in the news in the West. They've been a controversial bird that have been battled over for years, right? I am not the first to cover sage grouse. However, I will confess, avoided covering sage grouse as an environment reporter for many years because it just seemed like an obscure bird most of us will never see, not really sure what to do about them, how to keep them on the planet, frankly. People are struggling with that. And just esoteric enough that it was just going to be a real challenge to get listeners to listen, frankly, or to be excited about this story. And so I had kind of avoided it. And then when I left the city and moved to sagebrush country, and I should be clear that I live in a little valley about 20 miles from the Canadian border in Washington State, and there actually are no longer sage grouse in this valley. And Washington State is a bit of the ghost of Christmas future when it comes to sage grouse. We used to have sage grouse across the state. Now there are fewer than 1,000 left in Washington. And so as I started to learn more about that and that history, I wanted to find ways to connect this to humans. I almost took it on as like a creative challenge, I would say. Like, I didn't come into it thinking sage grouse are the most amazing thing. I want to, you know, this is a life-changing experience, you know, recording one. And I didn't know that when I started the series. It was sort of a journey of faith in many ways, as people talk about their religion, is like, you don't know, we can't know that God exists, but we can be curious about it. And we can choose to try to believe that there is something greater. And I think that is kind of, in a weird way, looking back on it, maybe how I approached the sage grouse story, is that I wanted to understand this bird. I wanted to see it in its natural environment. And I wanted to share the awe and the wonder that came from that experience. And so it's sort of in this roundabout way started this personal journey across the West to find this bird, but also to kind of explain why I cared about it, and maybe to help me rediscover how to care, because as I talk about in the first episode of the show, covering the environment can be really depressing, and it's very easy to start becoming numb and sort of keeping everything at an arm's length or not really engaging with the information that we're absorbing about what we're doing to the environment, because frankly, it can feel really hopeless. And I had certainly become a victim of that in my years of doing that work, you know, telling those stories. And so for me, the sage grouse was sort of trying to rediscover that wonder and that joy that got me into this work in the first place, and hoping that it could do that for my listeners in the process.
So yeah, that I think that what you just said really comes across in the first episode. You talked about some of those elements, and it seemed clear to me that when you were first speaking with Michael Schroeder, who's one of the key characters of the story, maybe in a way a hero of the story, along with the bird.
I would agree.
It sounded to me like the point where Michael made his passionate case in episode 2 for why people should care about the sage grouse. Like, that seemed to be the turning point where, as a listener anyway, where it seemed to click for you, like, okay, you have something here and this is going to work. Am I interpreting accurately, or were you already all in and committed at that point?
Well, I think in episode 2, that was a tough one to write because, you know, I was skeptical. You know, like I said, I was kind of bored with the sage grouse story before I even started and kind of numb in general. And I think that, you know, when I went out with Michael Schroeder in the snow that day to look for sage grouse here in Washington State, I wasn't wowed. Like, we did end up finding one female. You know, I didn't get a close look at her. She was not particularly impressive. Obviously, it wasn't mating season. She wasn't, you know, engaging with males when they do their big displays on their leks or mating sites. It was pretty uninspiring, an experience, if I'm being honest. And so at that moment, I knew that I had a character in Michael Schroeder, but I didn't know that I had a character in the bird. But I kind of used that as a narrative, maybe trick, to keep listeners with me because, you know, the whole series, if you notice, is sort of built toward that kind of climax moment of being in the Red Desert and hearing and seeing the birds up close for the first time. And I didn't want to blow my load in the second episode, you know, like you needed to kind of like pace it out and have it be a journey and have me be a little bit of a skeptical narrator on that journey. So Michael Schroeder, I couldn't have done it without him. And I think that what he kind of his comments, I debated about holding some of those comments for the final episode in post-production and ended up deciding to keep them in that second episode because I needed someone to be excited about the bird at that point because it wasn't me.
Yeah, so for me, it hit very close to home because I spend so much time trying to communicate environmental issues to people. And I've fallen into that routine of using like the concept of environmental services that are provided by different elements in nature. And that, you know, ties right back into economic incentives. So, you know, that's kind of an easy out, I think, at times to say, okay, if we need to convince somebody that this is important, let's put some dollar signs, attach dollar signs to it. And Michael made a very passionate argument, probably one of the best worded arguments I've heard about why we should care about the sage grouse just because it is. And you know, I almost think of him as a philosopher biologist. So let me just back up a little bit and tell the listeners that Michael, he's a biologist that's been studying the greater sage grouse for decades. and is perhaps nearing the end of his career. And I won't tip the final episode, but you know, he has a lot of perspective on this issue. So it carried a lot of weight when I heard that.
Yeah, I couldn't have made the series without him. And, you know, when you talk about public servants, these are the kinds of scientists that we should be celebrating and the work that they do day in and day out to monitor these ecosystems on public lands. He's such a gem and so dedicated. And his words, I have referred to him as a philosopher scientist myself, because he has an ability. And as a science journalist, those are the interviews you live for, right? Are where you find a scientist who can go there with you and speak to these larger, more universal human questions as opposed to just the data and the findings.
So you alluded to the complexity in writing the episodes. And, you know, as someone who just sees the end result, you know, released week after week after week, it's really easy to forget about the complexity that goes into that. How do you organize the story? And I'm wondering what your process is for developing such a complicated story. Do you create an outline? Do you just kind of see where the interviews take you? Like, I think there's a lot of different approaches you could have. And having never done it, I'm just curious how you do it.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that. The process stuff is really important. And I think we creatives, storytellers, maybe don't, I can certainly call myself out on this, don't spend enough time thinking on the front end and planning. And we're sort of drawn to shiny things often and sort of jump right in. And I think what I really challenged myself to do with this series was to really invest the time on the front end and the planning and to be deliberate about what I was trying to do here before I just launched into, you know, the excitement of going out in the field and trying to record one of these birds. And I think if I hadn't done that, I wouldn't have been able to tell the story that I did. So my process begins with a deep dive into the scientific literature. So I, apologies to the trees, but I printed out like a dozen scientific studies about sage grouse or more, and then read a handful more online. I'm just kind of immersed myself completely in the context of the bird, where it's been, what we know about it, even research from the 1920s, you know, writings from the original kind of advocates for the sage grouse and trying to protect it as its numbers began declining back then. And once I had that kind of deep context, then I started identifying key voices. You know, who are the senior citizens, scientists, senior, you know, professor emeritus of sage grouse? And that's where Michael Schroeder's name came up from several different places. And they just said, oh, well, if you want to talk to the guy, or, you know, his name was listed on several of the papers I was reading, that was kind of how I zeroed in on him. But I couldn't have known in reading his papers or hearing about it from other people that he would be the voice that he was in person. And that's always the gamble. You don't know that. But starting deep in the scientific literature, I think really equipped me to start asking the right questions and have the right, frankly, skepticism about what we're doing with sage grouse. Because when the data don't lie, right? Like, the numbers continue to decline across their range at a pretty astounding rate, you know, averaging 44% loss since 2015, right? And just in the past 5 years, we're talking. And there are certain pockets where the population is doing okay and or holding on, I should say. But having that key information sort of in my back pocket as I went into these interviews really helped me ask those hard questions when people were saying, oh, we're trying to do this, or we're working together to save the blah, 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 and, you know, protect this habitat and recover from wildfires. And I could sort of be like, okay, but it's not working. So now what? Tell me really what's going on here, you know? And then in terms of structuring it, I wanted to build it along the narrative arc of discovering the bird, you know, kind of on a quest for the bird with various different guides, and then using each episode to kind of explore the key threats to the bird. So I did an episode about wildfire, an episode about oil and gas, an episode about ranching, but really trying to, it was really important to me to have the voices of all the stakeholders. And I think a lot of times, especially in environmental journalism, I would clarify, which has a certain advocacy or activist bent, oil and gas won't even talk to journalists. They don't, you know, they don't stand to gain anything from engaging in a conversation with what they perceive as a liberal or extremely biased media. And so, you know, ranchers are in the same boat. They're very skeptical of journalists coming onto their property, especially when you say you're covering the environment. I mean, they do assume certain things about you. And so for me, having, you know, this was a year plus of production time, I was emailing and phone calling and working the rancher in the series and the oil and gas executive in the series for months before I showed up to do those interviews, and really trying to build trust. And I think, you know, I've heard from both of them after the fact that they really felt that I was fair. They felt that, you know, they got a fair shake. And that means a lot to me. And it's not that I am pro rancher or pro oil and gas. It's that I really wanted listeners to hear that perspective, because there is value in it. And there are, you know, these are folks who have good intentions and are stuck in a system just like we all are. That means you need to pay your mortgage and you need to support your family. And there are different ways of doing that. And it looks different all across the country, especially in the rural West. I think a lot of, frankly, wealthier city liberal coastal elites, as we say in this country, it's very easy to sit there and say, well, don't do that. That's bad for the landscape. And then when you actually drive through Wyoming and you look around, it's not a whole lot of ways to make a lot of money. And oil and gas is one of them. So trying to just show what that looks like on the ground, I think, was really important for me. And I am rambling about my process, but basically each episode builds towards that final experience with the bird and trying to go deep and sit with environmentalists and oil and gas and ranchers and all the different perspectives and stakeholders in sagebrush country. So loosely speaking, that was how it came together. Some episodes came together later than others. The wonderful interview with a Warm Springs elder, Wilson Wiwa, that came together later because the virus had just hit when I was supposed to go and visit him in person. And my dream was to go and sit with him. And that wasn't possible. The reservation was closed to outsiders for good reason. So I interviewed him in the studio. So certain things in the production, you know, bumps come up in the road and you kind of just navigate around them. But having a good roadmap at the outset was really important.
So yeah, if I could actually go a little bit deeper into the process, you mentioned that you had to work some of these more skeptical people for months before you were able actually to meet with them on their property and have the, you know, the interview that you played in the show. What does that initial introduction look like when you identify, say, in this case, a rancher, and you know that they have an interesting perspective? How do you start that conversation?
You know, it's a dance, because you don't want to misrepresent where you're coming from and what the story is that you're trying to tell. So I was always transparent. This is a podcast about sage grouse and why their numbers are declining. I'd really like to hear from all different perspectives. I want my listeners to understand your perspective. And then I couldn't have made this series if I didn't live in sagebrush ranching country. I will say that again. If I was not a part of a community where there are ranchers, if I didn't have a horse that I am learning how to move cows on, clumsily, I will add, I wouldn't have the currency or the language to communicate in such a way that I could build trust and rapport with these folks. You know, the oil and gas executive, we talked about motorcycles for like 20 minutes on the phone. And I, you know, just Sturgis and I ride a motorcycle. And so like just having that sort of like completely unrelated to the podcast, but just so that he could understand, you know, that we share certain interests, that we both love sagebrush country. He's an avid hunter and outdoorsman. And, you know, those kinds of just casual background conversations are harder to do over video and over telephone. But to me, they're critical in any reporting project. And, you know, when I was on deadline for a daily show for NPR or daily, you know, story that was probably 45 seconds to 3 minutes, you don't often have the luxury of building that rapport and really getting those sort of what I call heart tape from people. You get the informational tape, you know, you get the what happened, not the why or the how does that make you feel or how should we as humans feel about what happened. And so that's where podcasting has been a medium that I've really invested in heavily, because I feel like I can do better storytelling by having that lead time and then having also the time in production. Like each episode is 20 to 25 minutes. You know, that's a big difference from a 3 minute radio feature.
Right. You don't have the same limits to have to fit it into a specific segment, you know, so there's flexibility. If it goes 27 right. minutes, not a big deal.
Exactly.
So when we're talking about building a storyline, you know, there was one specific example that stood out to me. Your hook in episode one really had nothing to do with the grouse. It was in your backyard with an encounter with a rattlesnake. And I'm kind of a linear thinker, so that was a direction to start the show that I probably never would have thought of, but it worked really well. How did you decide to launch the whole series with that series of events?
That was actually, I have to give credit to my awesome editor, Whitney. I was telling her about, you know, my life here and how different it is. And she said, you know, I need you to show me, not tell me. She was like, is there one story or experience that you've had since moving to sagebrush country that really highlights how out of place you are and how ill-equipped you are as a newcomer? And I wanted to kind of ground the listener in that vulnerability and inexperience. And so I started the whole series with, there was a rattlesnake under the deck of my house, actually, and it almost got my dog when we'd first moved into the little cabin in sagebrush country. And I've gotten more hate mail for that story. People just writing and saying, I couldn't get past that. How could you call yourself an environment journalist and write about this or share this story? You gleefully were killing a wild animal that was doing no harm to you. And I think that was kind of the point, Michael. Like, that's kind of why I put it in there, is to show this deep division between urban and rural perspectives on how we live in an environment. And I am not saying that everybody out here kills rattlesnakes all the time. What I am saying is that when you actually live close to the land, certain things are sometimes necessary, that it's very easy to say are bad or wrong from an urban perspective. And so the only time I've killed rattlesnakes is when they are directly under my house. I see them in my garden. There was a giant one under my truck last summer that could have gotten me. I didn't even see it until I backed the truck up and there it was. I don't go around just like gleefully killing rattlesnakes, but I felt that need to protect my immediate, like the envelope of my home, really kicked in that moment. In the same way that when ranchers say they need to kill wolves who are repeatedly killing their cows and their calves, I have greater understanding for that urge now. Not that it's the same as killing a rattlesnake under a deck, but like that philosophy of just getting by in the rural parts of this wild country are different on the ground than they are in theory. And I think that's what I was trying to show. And it made a lot of people uncomfortable. And I would say, thank you for listening. And also, that was the point.
The story behind the story is really eye-opening for me. The fact that people would read into it that you were somehow gleefully doing that shows the lens through which some people see the world and how distorted that lens can be. So thank you for sharing that. And when people do send the hate mail after things like that, do you engage at all? Do you explain yourself?
I've struggled with that. It's really hard. You know, the interesting thing about making a podcast that's so deeply personal is that people write to you and they think they know you. You know, they write almost like they expect a personal response. And at the end of the day, like, I shared of myself for the sake of telling the story, but I don't know these people that have felt empowered to judge me through my storytelling. And that's where I have struggled with how to respond. And also with the deep understanding that just as with radical, conservative, NRA-toting Trump supporters, radical environmentalists share some DNA. And it's, you know, the task of changing those minds is not one that I feel equipped to take on oftentimes. And so usually I don't engage. Usually I don't write back because I, even now, you know, living in Trump country, I don't think that I can change people's minds. I think what I can do is show empathy and listen and hope that the favor is returned. And maybe at some point, maybe both of our viewpoints can be softened. But writing a well-worded, strong response to explain why I did something in the podcast to somebody who's already judged me for doing it doesn't seem like a great use of my time, in all honesty. So no, I haven't responded. But I appreciate the opportunity to kind of talk about why that first episode sounded the way it did right at the top.
Mm-hmm. The production effort that goes into something like this, I guess I already know the answer to this because you list the credits at the end of your show, but is it all you? And when it comes to editing and, you know, audio production and the engineering aspect, how does that look? How do you interact with other people to produce the final product?
Yeah. If there's one thing that I truly cherish about working for myself is that I now choose who I work with. And I didn't have that luxury at NPR. You know, when I was making Terrestrial, my manager was my manager, and whatever his take on what was a good story was a very powerful voice in the making of that show. And now I get to pick. And I work with some of the smartest, most talented, most creative women in the business. Whitney Henry Lester is my editor, and she was formerly with StoryCorps and now is a freelancer who also does editing for 99% Invisible and just has a really calm, patient, but searing eye for story and frankly doesn't put up with my bullshit. Like, I'll get all excited about something and I'll want to run down a rabbit hole and she'll just say, nope. You don't have me here. You gotta convince me that this is important. Why are you doing this? This tangent doesn't work. It's not relevant. And she can be brutal, but I really respect her judgment. So bringing her on early in the process was key. And so we would have lengthy phone calls in the early days just about what is this thing that you want to make? You know, why do you want to make it? What is your investment? How much of a character are you in the story? And if it's not you, can the sage grouse carry the water for this story and engage listeners the way we need to keep them hooked for 8 episodes? So her critical eye was so important. And then Liza Yeager. So I did all of the research, reporting, field recording, interviewing, writing, and then I also pulled all the tapes. So all of the, I would line up all of the, you know, actualities, the quotes from people, and then the ambient sound from the field. And then I would put that into, I would just bounce that into zeroed out tracks and send them to Liza Yeager. And she is an up-and-coming star who everyone should be watching in this line of work, and I hope I can afford her and keep working with her in the future because she's brilliant. She was formerly with Invisibilia and Planet Money as an intern and producer, and does just phenomenal sound design. I'm not a very musical person, so I really value that in other people, and I know that it's worth paying for. And some of the critical acclaim for Grouse was for the sound design specifically. Liza just did a phenomenal job. So having those two women in my corner and working with them, you know, not just in the, you know, Liza would often have really thoughtful comments about the episodes themselves when she was listening and sound designing them. She wasn't just there to kind of do the music. She has a great ear as well. And so a lot of changes were made at the very end based on her kind of gut response to certain things in there. So yeah, I couldn't have made this series without those awesome gals. And I really look forward to working with them in the future.
Thanks for a little peek behind the scenes there. And I guess a lot, one of the sub themes of what we've been talking about is your own personal journey. You mentioned that you worked at NPR for a while. You have a background in journalism. And I heard an interview with you from, I guess, 2017. So it's been a few years ago, where you said that you don't consider yourself an environmentalist. And I understand that perspective when you're doing journalism, because you want to be unbiased, and environmentalist carries a lot of connotation with it. So where I'm going with this question, at the beginning of Grouse, you talked about being numb to your own stories. And at the end, you had a bit of a transformation. So I'm wondering, how do you reconcile those conflicting points of view, I suppose, of being impartial, but getting more emotionally invested into the story?
Well, are you saying that I transformed into an environmentalist?
I'm wondering how you feel, like how would you identify yourself now? And do you fear that it could take away from some of the core journalism?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I think that the biggest lie we tell ourselves is that we are unbiased as journalists, as, you know, humans. But I think the lie that journalism has been telling itself for a long time is that journalists are unbiased. Everybody that works at NPR in Seattle is liberal, right? Like, that's just, I know all those people, and I'm not outing them by saying that. It's just like in their personal lives, they are liberal in their leanings, right? So let's just call it, you know, I don't see why, what is the obsession with this? You know, it doesn't mean that their journalism is bad. If you're driven by facts and if you're driven by compelling narrative and you're doing your job well and you're well-trained, I just don't see that those things are mutually exclusive. Now, on the environmentalist side, environmentalists piss me off. Okay. And I think that the word is, has also changed over the years and has taken on a negative connotation, certainly in sagebrush country where I live now. But I will say that when I lived in Seattle for, you know, 7 or 8 years, the hate mail I would get was from environmentalists, was from radical liberals who didn't feel like even my speaking to an oil and gas executive when I would try to do that in my daily reporting was valid, that they were not open to hearing those perspectives because they were so blindly in service of this one line of thought. And so I guess I, in the same way, I don't understand why environmentalism has become such a partisan issue, because I would call Merrill Beeler, the rancher in episode 4, an environmentalist. But he would never call himself an environmentalist, right? He cares deeply about the environment. But the problem with, I think, environmentalism, and I mean this more in the sense of like big green rather than grassroots, you know, organizers who are cleaning up their own small communities, I mean that more in the mega, like well-funded national environmental groups. I think that they have alienated so many people who are actually environmentalists in the same way. So this word, I guess, is where I get hung up on it. It's that, you know, everybody cares about the environment. I mean, you can't be an animal and not care about the ecosystem in which you find yourself. Some of us are misled or misinformed about how we impact the environment. But to me, I don't call myself an environmentalist because I don't, I see it, it's almost like, does a fish like water? Like, yes, we all like water, right? We're all swimming in it. We're all in an environment. And so I think that the thing with maybe city people is you can be a little bit more divorced from your environment. But the country people I've met since moving to Sagebrush Country are just as deeply committed to this landscape as anybody who drives out from Seattle on the weekends to recreate here, if not more committed to that, to this environment. They will fight and die for it in many instances, you know? And so I guess that's where it's not unlike thinking about the term feminism, a feminist, right? Like women out here, you'd be good goddamned if you're going to call them feminists, even though they are just as badass, if not more, than a lot of the, their male counterparts in the ranching community in terms of the burdens they carry, the duties they carry around raising children, running working ranches, being active members of their communities on PTAs, and then also not being the owners of the ranches that they work on. It's the word that turns people off. And I think the same could be said about the word environmentalist, that you could be advocating for equality as a woman rancher, but not call yourself a feminist. You can be fighting for healthy sagebrush and never call yourself an environmentalist. And so I think that's where I take issue with the term. And I think it needs to be reexamined and maybe discarded in some communities.
I love that perspective. And one of the things that really gets me going across the board is the use of a single word label to try to communicate a complex, nuanced sort of idea. And when we talk about the environment, that's always the case. It's always complex. Solutions for one part of the world are going to vary dramatically from solutions in another part of the world. And that part of the world might be as close by as 30 miles down the road, or it might be right. Africa. So yeah, I really appreciate the nuance that you bring to that discussion, which is why I wanted to get your direct view here. Yeah, back to your professional resume, you have all this experience, you know, working at PRI and NPR and kind of climbing the corporate ranks, I think are the words that you used. And then you decided to basically go into business for yourself. Was that always part of the plan, or was there a day that you just sort of woke up and realized that this sort of more corporate life isn't for me?
I wish I could say I had a plan. It's not like the Sage Grouse podcast. I had a plan for that. No, life doesn't work that way. So there's a saying I heard recently from another woman in public radio who recently quit her job and basically started, you know, is working now for an independent company making podcasts and doing excellent work. And she said that it's not a glass ceiling for young creative women, it's a glass cliff. And what that means is you work your tail off, you out-hustle everyone around you. In my case, you raise all the money even to make your own show. And then when you're not given control, you're put in situations again and again where you have to fight for what you feel you are owed. And eventually what happens is you get pushed off the cliff. They push you to the point where you jump, when really you would have loved to keep working within the system and the platform and the good work, because I still adore NPR. I still file stories for NPR. And nationally, shows like Here and Now, I have excellent relationships with and love working with. But in terms of within the corporate structure, I think there's still a lot of work to be done to really empower and celebrate creative voices. And I will say, especially young women, at least in my work experience, the member station in Seattle where I worked has lost 3 or 4 that I can think of off the top of my head, creative young women who were not supported and encouraged and promoted. And so there's a systemic problem there that I am not afraid to speak to. But I also think that there was a moment for me, you know, I'd been sort of spinning my tires. I was making Terrestrial, the podcast, the climate change podcast for NPR and KUOW. And I loved that work. I stayed much longer than I maybe should have because I cared so much about the content. And I think that's how they get you in public radio. People are mission driven and they know that. And so they pay you less and they work you harder. And I think that it was a gradual realization that I needed to be free to pursue the stories that I wanted to pursue in the way that I wanted to pursue them, more importantly. I was out visiting this valley where I live now, and I had met this woman, and she'd taken me out horseback riding, and we were galloping up this snowy hillside, and I had this like just shit-eating grin across my face, and I hadn't been that happy in a really long time because I'd just been, you know, working 80-hour weeks, you know, just so immersed in making a thing, making the show, that I had sort of lost perspective. And I think what I hadn't realized yet maybe was it was affecting my ability to make the best content because, again, that numbness was creeping in and you just become a sort of a slave to the machine as opposed to thinking creatively about what the kinds of stories you want to tell in the world and the kind of storyteller I wanted to be. I came back from that ride and I told my husband I wanted to quit my job, and he was already kind of pushing to make a big life change for us. I think we were kind of ready to leave the city. He's a mountain boy from Colorado, and so I think the coast was, you know, he was getting kind of tired of it as well. And yeah, so we made the jump, and I have never looked back. It's been almost actually this past, you know, a couple of days ago was the 3-year anniversary of quitting my job, and I'm just as successful in terms of finances, and I control my days, and you know, I move cows for ranchers in the afternoons sometimes when they need my help and rearrange my schedule accordingly so I can do that. And it's all part of my work because it informs how I do journalism now is those relationships. And, you know, the kind of where I draw creativity or inspiration for stories has completely changed. And the kinds of voices that I want to find and bring to a broader listenership is completely different. And I think most journalists have to live in cities. Maybe that's changing with the pandemic, but we've always been sort of confined to where the jobs are. And unfortunately, I think that's a disservice to rural America. And I think that I feel just really inspired being in this place and being able to pursue these stories on my own terms, on my own timeframes, and with my own chosen collaborators.
So how do you characterize yourself now? Are you a journalist, an independent producer, a company owner?
I call myself chief creative overlord of Ahern Productions. So I'm still a journalist and I still, you know, cover news here and there. And I am deeply committed to scientific accuracy and communicating about science and connecting people with complex issues that they face, that we face in an environment that we are changing, I would say is how I describe what I do. And I do call it journalism, yes.
So connecting people to these complex science stories, whether they're environmentally slanted or otherwise, is something that, you know, I'm really looking to learn about and to do a better job with this podcast. So I always ask, like, what have you found to be methods or approaches that tend to work better in this audio medium?
Well, I think that any opportunity to take people on a journey and to immerse them in the sounds of a place is a way to inspire and create connection with the stories about the environment. And I've always done that. Even, you know, at NPR, I was always, nobody knew where I was. I was out recording with scientists, you know, on the Elwha River about dam removal or whatever, you know, and I'd come back with tape. And it was always stories that would immerse people in the natural world. To me, I think that's the easiest way to help people connect is with their ears through sound. And then the next thing I would say is focusing on the voices and, most importantly, the passion that people have and the wonder that people have for the places where they live or the things that they study, whether that's a salmon biologist on the Olympic Peninsula or that's a rancher in rural Idaho. I think that those voices are sometimes hard to find and they're worth pursuing because environmental groups are really good about sending out press releases and trying to connect you with their pundits about the issues and to get their perspectives heard in the media. Ranchers are less inclined to do that. Scientists are less inclined to self-promote or put themselves out there as interviewees. And so really kind of actively seeking out the people who maybe don't want to grab the microphone and make their point is another way to I think, really connect with the broader public, the people who are just going about their daily lives but may have a very deep connection with the environment if they choose to reflect on it with me and my microphone.
Yeah, a lot of people just, I found, have to get over the hump of knowing that they're being recorded. And if you can get past that, then they really open up. But yeah, others are a little tougher nuts to crack.
Mm-hmm.
So you alluded to a new series that you're working on. I saw on a tweet from you, actually. So what can we expect from your productions going forward?
So living in ranching country, I have become increasingly aware of the roles that women play. Ranching country can be very conservative and very patriarchal. However, over the generations, women have played a critical role in successful ranching operations across the West. And what I think we're starting to see in more recent years is the adoption or more women stepping into leadership roles, decision-making roles, and management roles on working ranches. And what that's also meant, and it sort of goes hand in hand with, is the embracing of more sustainable and holistic land management practices. And so as I've kind of been exploring more, and what I mean by that is everything from better managing wolf predation on cattle to adopting soil conservation techniques that can improve carbon sequestration in soil and soil health, or rotational grazing to prevent overgrazing the landscape. It can go a lot of different directions, but women seem to be leading this charge and producing a series in partnership with Boise State Public Radio, as was Grouse, that will feature women all across the West who are taking on leadership roles on their working ranches and changing the way business is done.
That sounds really interesting. Are you at this stage able to give a timeline as to when we might actually see that drop?
Yeah, you know, the production timeline is similar to Grouse. It's a year. I'm going to be basically, right now I'm reading scientific literature and fully immersed, and on my desk right now are scientific papers with titles like Gendered Practices of Cultural Resilience in Working Rangeland Landscapes. and I'm just kind of deeply reading, and once the snow goes and hopefully the virus subsides, I'll be out recording, you know, sleeping in the back of my pickup truck and driving all over the West with my wireless microphone to try to get these voices captured, these amazing women that are out in the landscape working and will hopefully take me along for the ride. And in the meantime, I'm teaching myself how to throw a lasso and train a horse. So I have an Arabian mare who is a bit high-spirited and not superbly trained, and she and I are learning together.
Full immersion, it sounds like.
Yes, that's the key.
One other thing I think I neglected to ask about, a lot of my audience here anyway, they're either naturalists or birders or people who, like myself, are looking to make a transition in their own careers to get into something a little bit more environmentally friendly. I'm guessing there are some folks that are wondering, how can they help with some of these issues in the West, especially with the greater sage grouse? Do you have any pointers as to some of the organizations you might point them to learn more or get engaged directly?
You know, one of the things I would love to see happen more is for birding groups or other kind of environmental groups in cities to get in touch with their rural counterparts and try to get volunteer groups together to go out into the sagebrush. What I saw and what you'll hear about in the wildfire episode is that we have a crisis in terms of millions of acres of sagebrush, sage grouse habitat burning every year, and the increasing spread of invasive grasses. And we're talking a Herculean effort to prevent that from continuing to happen. And it happens by replanting native seeds. That is incredibly labor-intensive, time-consuming, expensive. But I would love to see if, you know, the Seattle Audubon chapter could go out, make a trip to Eastern Washington and plant and help local ranchers maybe fix fences. And in doing so, add, you know, they hang these little pieces of plastic on barbed wire fence to prevent sage grouse from flying into them, right? When they're mating, male sage grouse, as you would imagine, are completely distracted and they're not great flyers to begin with. And they die when they hit barbed wire, very, very frequently, actually. And so here's a very simple thing that any volunteer could do, is just walking miles of barbed wire and attaching things that will help the birds better see it when they're flying. So, you know, with climate change, it's hard. There aren't as many concrete things maybe that we can, as individuals, do and really move the needle. And similarly with sage grouse, it is going to be, we're talking millions of acres of habitat that's under threat and the birds are not doing very well. So I wouldn't lie to people and say, we're going to save sage grouse. But what I will say is there are very concrete and tangible tasks that we can undertake that can not only help sage grouse on their landscape, but also better connect us as humans with one another through a shared love of sagebrush country and through inviting people with different perspectives to help. I think ranchers aren't good at asking for help. They don't like outsiders coming in very, I'm generalizing, but there is a skepticism or a, I don't know, hesitation toward inviting others onto their property. I think, though, that especially after wildfire, when everybody's looking for help and trying to figure out how to heal, there is an opportunity to bring in some volunteers. So I guess that's one thing that comes to mind when I think about what can people do. It's trying to find ways to reach outside of your bubble and, you know, and meet people where they are, as opposed to criticizing them or worrying about what's happening to the bird from afar.
The way you word it, it sounds so obvious and common sense, but I know that I rarely think in those terms. It's basically finding that common ground to start from. Mm-hmm. And then you can build off of that.
Yeah.
Maybe to wrap things up, consider these maybe more rapid fire questions, I suppose.
Okay.
So don't think too hard. But you mentioned in multiple places that you're an audio obsessed journalist. And I guess part one of that question is, what do you mean by audio obsessed? And part two would be, what do you listen to that maybe tweaks that need for, you know, good audio?
Hmm. Oh, gosh. Well, audio obsessed means exactly that. I am obsessed with sound. I am the person that will call up a scientist and ask them, you know, where can you take me? What are the sounds I will hear there? How do I bring this scene to life for listeners who can't join us in these amazing places? But, you know, in my day-to-day life, I never wear earbuds when I'm out either running or hiking, or, you know, a lot of people will get out for a workout and they'll be listening to podcasts. And I actually feel on some level, especially in the great natural expanses of sagebrush that I inhabit, it feels almost disrespectful to not be listening to the landscape and the sounds that it produces, the sounds of my horse's hoofbeats, the smells, the distant coyotes that I hear every night. I live for those sounds. I can't imagine life without them. So I think that's what audio obsessed means to me, both from a storytelling, but also from a personal standpoint.
And I'm curious if you have any favorite podcasts or recurring shows that you listen to.
I don't listen to a lot of nature podcasts, to be honest. I don't know what that is. I think it's something about sort of a feeling that a lot of it can feel very disconnected from the actual communities who live on the land. And so when I think about the kinds of podcasts I actually want to listen to, I really enjoyed the Bundyville series from OPB. Really gets into the sagebrush country and the conflicts there. And I've also always really loved Anna Sale's work with Death, Sex, and Money, because she, even though she's not field recording these stories, she gets heart tape out of people. As I mentioned earlier, that those kind of philosophical reflections about how we live in the world, to me, makes a better nature podcast, makes a better environment podcast, right alongside the importance of those natural sounds. So I would say those are probably my top listens or influences. I also have always loved Scott Carrier's work and Home of the Brave. His show is really beautifully produced and also very immersive in sound and field recordings.
Great. A couple ideas I can add to my list. So if people want to follow your work, where are the best places they can go?
I probably do more of my kind of behind the scenes, just everyday life, and also post a lot of pictures from reporting in the field on my Instagram more than Twitter, I would say, which is, I think the handle is just Ashley Reports. I don't post a lot on Facebook, and I was thinking about a newsletter, but I feel like everybody has newsletters these days, so I'm not sure if I'm going to do that. I think probably Instagram is the best, and Twitter. It's just A. Ahern on Twitter.
All right, Ashley, I really appreciate all the time you've taken today. It's been a fun conversation. I hope you've enjoyed it as well.
I certainly have, Michael. Thanks so much for having me.
We live in a world where sound bites dominate and true understanding is shrinking. Nature's Archive podcast digs a little bit deeper, hoping to help the world understand nature just a little bit more. I hope that this podcast has planted a seed of interest that will grow into something special for you. I record, produce, edit, and publish a show by myself as a personal passion. If you enjoyed the show, please rate it on iTunes or your favorite podcast service, and then please turn around and share this episode with a friend or a family member that you think might like it. I'm not asking for money or donations, just a gift of sharing. Thanks for your support. You can also follow me on Instagram at Nature's Archive or Facebook, also Nature's Archive. In addition to sharing information about podcasts at those locations, I also share some of my photography and some short explanations of what I'm seeing. Lastly, if you have any suggestions for guests or topics for me to cover, please email me at naturesarchivepodcast@gmail.com. Thank you. And one last word, I want to make sure to give credit to the music that you hear in the podcast. The opening song is called Fearless First by Kevin MacLeod, and the closing song is called Beauty Flow, also by Kevin MacLeod. You can find his work at incompetech.filmmusic.io.